it's time. 50 years since Lazio's shooting stars won their first Scudetto. Yeah, I like that one as well. I was pleased with that.
That was good.
That's possibly my finest work of the week. Hello and welcome to By Far the Greatest Team, a podcast in which football fans attempt the seemingly impossible to rank once and for all who is the greatest football teams of all time. My name's Graham Dunn, putting the case for Oxford United whenever relevant, and our king of the data, joining me as ever, is Jamie Rooney. Hiya, Jamie.
Graham, good evening. The last 2 weeks have been quite extreme. We've gone from arguably the greatest to one of the greatest football teams of all time in Ajax, and this is why we do this thing, to one of the most important but not so great football teams of all time, which is the Rochester Lancers. And they were involved, as you remember, an incredible match where the winning goal was scored, I think, in the 176th minute. I felt compelled to see if there are any football matches that have lasted longer than that. This, I didn't want to go back into the world of endless replays where you could accumulate huge volumes of time for a football match. I actually looked at a game that would have been completed on the night. And 176 minutes is not the longest. 203 minutes is actually the longest, and it took place in 1946, and it took place in England in a Division 3 Northern Cup match. Stockport County, Doncaster Rovers, they've already drawn 2-2 in the first leg. They've gone into the second leg. They've drawn 2-2 after 90 minutes. They play an additional 30 minutes, and they don't have any decider. There's no extra goals. So there was a rule back then in English Football League called play to win. So they had to play on until the next team scored who would win in a golden goal scenario, something that Sepp Blatter brought in the 2000s that was already in place in the 1940s in England. And in the 173rd minute, Stockport scored. So 173rd minute, they don't beat 176 minute from the Rochester Lancers. However, the crowd are going crazy. I say they're going crazy. They're probably just relieved because they can go home because they've been watching almost 3 hours of football. And yet the referee, in the mix of this confusion, has blown the whistle because he's seen a handball. So he's disallowed the goal. So the relief of this game being over is completely destroyed by the referee saying, no, it's not a goal. We carry on. They get to the 203rd minute where the players apparently are just falling over. The crowd are sick. The players are sick. They just want to go home. And it's in the days before floodlights. So it's getting a bit dark. So the referee says, okay, let's just call it a night. 203 minutes, Stockport County, Doncaster Rover, the longest football match in the history of the game.
And they just call it a day.
They toss a coin, and we've done that before. If you remember the great Gornik Zabza story of who is going to host the rematch. They play a third match, and Doncaster Rovers win 4-0 comfortably and go through to the next round.
That's the closest you're going to get to the day-to-day sketch with the Alan Partridge, Dumbarton v. Taste of Stenhouse Muir. Cannot be stopped as a football result. We've also been talking quite a lot about goal difference, and I think part of that came up as I noted the quite impressive Ajax goal difference. They don't win the title, actually. They come second, don't they, in Johan Cruyff's, one of his first seasons as manager of them.
That's correct. I haven't done a great deal of digging on this, but I've done some in more recent history, more football history. There have been teams that have had massive goal difference that haven't gone on to win the championship. Some may say this is a bit Spursy, because in 2016-17, Tottenham finished the Premier League in second place with a goal difference of plus 60. This is Tottenham Hotspur, and it's plus 60 in the Premier League. But they didn't win the league. Chelsea did. Fast forward, just two seasons. Manchester City win the Premier League. Liverpool come second with a plus 67 goal difference, and they don't win the Premier League. However, Barcelona are the kings. They're the ones that hold the record. Just in the last few years, they came second to Real Madrid with a goal difference of plus 85. Plus 85 in a 38-game season, and they never won the league.
That is crazy. We don't expect to see 85 goal swings in Italian football, and there's never been any sign of that. And we're going to be talking about Italy today. And where else would we go if we're looking for our Italian specialist? Then to up until now, a man who you haven't let out of the Northeast. But welcome back, Philip Craig.
Hi, Graham. Hi, Jamie.
I don't really know how we've allowed you to go outside of that existence. Although you did the Cosmos, didn't you?
Most of the focus has been on, first of all, Sunderland, and then the first World Cup winners, West Auckland. And then I ventured outside of the Northeast just into West Yorkshire with the great Leeds teams in the 1960s and 1970s. So we're going to be staying in the same ballpark in terms of time, if not in geography.
Some consistency of time. Now, there's something I've become quite interested. We've referenced the big match a few times recently, partly because we've been watching a lot of that on ITVX. So I do recommend it. It's just, without fail, it is remarkably entertaining. But of course, it suddenly occurred to me that actually the big match was London and the Southeast version. That was for, you know, when ITV was split up into the different regions of regional television. Of course, depending where you were in the country in the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you'd have got not necessarily the big match and not necessarily Brian Moore. I mean, Phil, growing up in the Northeast, you didn't get the big match, did you?
No, we didn't. Genuinely had no idea who Brian Moore was or why he was such a big celebrity outside of maybe some international games. Because in the Northeast, because you had the kind of the regional ITV, we had Time Tees. Time Tees was our station. And on a Sunday afternoon around 2 o'clock, we'd get Shoot. Shoot would be our kind of opt-out for Time Tees. That would be presented by a chap called George Taylor. And Roger Thames used to do the commentary, and it would alternate week on week, depending on who was playing at home. If Sunderland were playing at home, there'd be the highlights of their game. And then you'd get, for some reason, shorter highlights of the away game, which kind of doesn't make any sense. So Newcastle might be there if they were playing away. They'd have some kind of highlights of that game as well. And then you'd have slightly shorter versions for Middlesbrough, Hartlepool and Darlington as well.
So I love the different experiences, and that idea that Brian Moore is actually only well known to anyone. You'd have only picked it up on maybe watching cup finals and, as you say, England internationals, maybe.
Yeah, it was completely alien to somebody like me. I had no idea, and it probably extended into other kind of TV opt outs as well. I remember being baffled as to who Shaw Taylor was, which is probably slightly shows my age a little bit. But it was, I remember it was only probably when I went to university in the late 1980s. I was in London, and there was all these people would appear up. Oh, that's why he's on TV. That's why he's famous. I had no idea. You know, we had Wincy Willis.
Shaw Taylor, of course, that absolutely makes sense, because Police 5 was always on just before the big match. I don't know if ITV thought there was a kind of, if there's something in the scheduling that they thought, I reckon the people who are likely to shop a villain are also the same demographic who like watching the footy on a Sunday afternoon.
I had completely forgotten about this person. And suddenly I've just been washed back to my childhood Sundays. You know, Elvis Presley LPs playing consistently in the morning as my mum makes the Sunday roast. You sit down to the Sunday roast and then you watch Police 5 and the big match. I mean, thank you so much for that historical reference. That's wonderful. But what I'm worried about with the regional big match being branded and called something else is the theme tune. Because the theme tune, Brian Moore was fantastic, but the theme tune I absolutely adored. And now I'm thinking, were we in the southeast of England? Were we just benefiting from that amazing theme tune? And Phil, I don't know if you're, my musical talents aren't great, but it used to go something like and then go dum. And I'm just worried, did you get that or was that just for us in the southeast?
No, it was just for you. We didn't have anything as sophisticated as that. It's going back into my memory, but it had somewhere in my kind of memory, it's quite distant now. There was something to do with a fair bit of clapping, and then you'd go shoot something on again, a clap, 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 clap.
Oh, yeah,
clap,
yeah, that
shoot.
Makes sense.
And that was it. It also reminds me, on a Sunday morning, there was another opt out, which had Jack Charlton doing coaching. It probably wasn't so long after he'd been Middlesbrough manager, and obviously he's from the region and from Northumberland. And I always remember thinking, right, I'd learn from a master. This is somebody who's won a World Cup. Jack Charlton, in his coaching, as far as I could tell, for about 20 of the 25 minutes, just taught young players how to foul. This is how you do a legal shoulder charge. Brilliant.
We will be delving more into such things with whenever we speak to anyone who might have watched something other, and we'll try and build this map together. What is by far the greatest Sunday afternoon ITV regional football franchise program. But that's for another day. We should get on with today's team, and we are looking at Lazio. I suppose the first question, Jamie, we should ask is, we're looking at this Lazio title winners. Why? But we're looking at the 1974 winners and not Sven-Göran Eriksson's all-conquering showbiz Lazio winners. So why are we looking at this team?
We're paying respect to their anniversary, first and foremost, 50 years since they won their first of two Scudettos. I suppose they're kind of like a Tottenham Hotspurs of Serie A. They've generally competed in the top division. They're SS Lazio, Società Sportiva Lazio. Lazio is a, for those who know Italy, is a region. In that region is the capital, Rome. Rome share the honours in terms of the big and major football teams with Lazio, and they both play at the Olympic Stadium. Lazio themselves have won a number of cups along their way. They've been a fairly successful football team. But again, like we talked about with Napoli a few weeks ago, they struggle with the strength of the north of Italy and, you know, the north-south divide. And although Lazio is not in the south, it's very much in the middle bracket, and the northern teams generally dominate Italian football. So we're celebrating a infrequent winner of the Scudetto in Italy. And also, Graham, the story, as we're going to find out, it's just ridiculous.
I think the other thing we were drawn to, and it gives us a chance to talk again about Giorgio Canaglia, the star of New York Cosmos, who myself, Jamie, and Phil waxed lyrical about a few months back. And he is at the heart of this team as well. And it's quite nice seeing how some of these players recur across time. One of the things which is comes across throughout this story is that it's not straightforward for Lazio throughout any of this time. And there seems to be sort of there's no shortage of controversy and there's no shortage of troubles, I guess. And we even see that before any of this kind of story begins with some problems in Europe with playing Arsenal.
We're going back to September 1970, when Arsenal were the holders of the Fairs Cup, which of course now we think of as later the UEFA Cup, which is just a reference to you getting that wrong the other day on a previous podcast, Graham. So it's the Fairs Cup at this point. The first round of the 1970 competition, the first leg fairly uneventful, and an interesting game, finished 2-2 in Rome. There was a rather formal dinner that followed, with the teams together sitting on separate tables, which is probably for the best after kind of quite a competitive game. And there are different versions of what actually happened at this event. According to one version, the one I kind of quite like, there was a bit of trouble that broke out when some of the Arsenal players complained about the bags that had been given to them by the Lazio team, which were felt to be a little bit effeminate, probably for the time, maybe not so much now, but for the time, they were felt to be a little bit effeminate. And some of the Arsenal players at the time started throwing around the bags. One of the bags was then thrown back by a Lazio player. It hit one of the Arsenal players, Bob McNabb, in the face, who then was grabbed by one of the Lazio players. The story goes by his ears. I'm not quite sure which part of his anatomy it actually was. Before all of the other players piled in, the fight, I think, ended up spilling out into the street, and even both managers started to kind of get involved. So Bertie Mee was the manager of Arsenal at the time. Not somebody known for getting particularly aggressive, even in the kind of the heat of a football match, but apparently he allegedly grabbed Lorenzo, the Lazio manager at the time, was actually the manager of the Argentinian team during the 1966 World Cup. So there was a certain degree of maybe aggression kind of built in there, or trying to kind of get back for past games. Everything eventually kind of calmed down. Arsenal actually went on to win the return at Highbury 2-0. But there was a kind of Fairs Cup committee that was set up afterwards to look at the events of the restaurant and what actually kind of happened in the fight. At this point, it seems like a slight anticlimax. This Fairs Cup committee looked into the fight that took place. They didn't actually take any action other than to warn both teams. But that warning is going to become quite important a few years later, when Lazio do qualify for Europe in the European Cup.
I absolutely love the idea of having to go for a formal dinner after a game.
It's worth pointing out on the handbags. It's a classic cultural clash between sartorial Italy, the England, which is slowly catching up. But The Guardian in 2003, The Guardian actually did handbags and headbutts. And out of five, they gave that particular fight between Lazio and Arsenal on the streets of Rome a handbag rating of 3.
And I guess this sort of goes to place, you know, aside from their troubles in Europe, this is really where we start to pick up the story, because Lazio are relegated. They're in, as you say, they've largely been in Serie A throughout this time, but they're relegated to the second division, and it's at this point there's a change in their fortunes, Jamie, isn't there?
They recruit a manager, Tommaso Mestrelli, in 1971, and Mestrelli's just come from being fairly successful with Foggia. He's won the manager of the year, the equivalent of the, and they call it the Golden Sow in Italy in terms of the translation, but it translates to the manager of the year. Lazio recruit him, and in Mestrelli they've got a man who's got human qualities. He's very much in tune with his players. He's very much in touch with the emotional side of the game, as the physical and mental attributes you need to play football. So he's kind of a father figure, and he harvests a collective within the group, which we'll go on to explore, that is not the easiest job that he would have had with this particular bunch of Lazio players. But he's also got a vision for how football should be played, and he's learned from one of the greatest at the time, which is Rinus Michels, who developed the total football as we know it as today. And he'd taken elements of that particular game and he brought them into Italian football at a time when Italian football was very much catenaccio in terms of, you know, just locking the defence. And while Mestrelli was definitely keen to keep the back door tight and locked, he was also open to the idea of being a bit dynamic in how his teams played.
Did they get promoted in his first season as manager?
71-72, they go up in second place behind Tanana, and also Palermo go up. But they're from Serie B, they go into Serie A. And when they get into Serie A in 72-73, it's the two teams that go up with them, Tanana and Palermo, both go down the following season. So Lazio, who have finished in between them in second place, generally not too much is expected of them. But Tommaso Mestrelli has different ideas. He sees a group of players that he believes in, And he's also made some key signings as well in the season before, in the 1972 summer. He makes some pretty key signings, and that's part of, I think, the bigger picture of where he's aiming for.
Now, at this stage, the club already have the legend that is Canaglia, don't they?
He's there.
For anyone who didn't hear our multiple references, he grows up in Wales and actually plays a handful of games, I think, for Swansea City. And then I think he has to return to Italy to do national service. Oh, slightly weirdly, because I hadn't realised this, but one of the reasons he ended up quite a slow return to the top tier was that he was banned, because he played professional football outside of Italy, he was banned from playing in Serie A or in the top league for 3 seasons. So he had to start at a rung below, which seems a bit strange.
Yeah, that's right. It's an incredible story, because you're right, it starts in South Wales, in Swansea, because his father, as you can imagine, after the war, to find work, travelled from Italy to South Wales and found some work in the steel industry. He initially left his son in Italy with his grandmother before the young Giorgio was reunited with his family when he was around 6 years old. Swansea Town, as they were called then, rather than Swansea City, I think, spotted mm-hmm. his potential. He was playing in the local kind of Cardiff Schools League and signed him on as an apprentice. He only went on to play 6 games and scored 1 goal. And I think he did leave Wales, I think it was in 1966, partly to serve his Italian military service. Although before that, there had been, and this is a precursor of what might have followed, a few clashes with some of the managers and some of the other players in the team. He famously told them, you know, one day you'll be asking me for my autograph or something similar, but in Italian, maybe with expletive. So he was banned from playing in Serie A for 3 years, had to drop down into the Italian third division, later joined Inter Napoli, the Napoli B team, now their defunct second team, before joining Lazio in 1969 and went on to play until 1976 and had a fantastic career in Lazio and Rome.
Was he the first, the kind of Steve Bull of Italian football? Because he, I think, is the first player to get capped for Italy whilst playing in the second tier. I don't know whether he's appeared on Question of Sport, which ties in with another of our questions of whether anyone other than Rick Holden has been a second tier player that's appeared on Question of Sport.
I suppose he's now most famous, at least outside of Italy, because I think he was the Italian player who provided the pass, which was scored in the qualifier, which led to Italy qualifying for the 1974 World Cup finals, England not qualifying for those World Cup finals, and that being the last game. Was it the last game for Alf Ramsey? He certainly didn't last long after that as well. So he was instrumental in drawing a line under what had been quite a successful period in English football.
So he was already the legend, and he does have this unbelievable scoring record across his entire career, where he's almost like a goal a game over, I don't know, 700, 800 goals. It's just a ludicrous record.
I think in that promotion season in 71-72, he really kind of kicked in. He was top scorer, got 21 goals, which even in the Italian second division is still pretty impressive.
Jamie, as you were saying, some of the other parts of the jigsaw were signed that in that promotion winning season?
In 1972, they got rid of a player called Massa, who went to Inter Milan. He was a very popular player, very good player, but they were able to get a good amount of money from him at the time. And with that money, Tommaso Mastrelli was able to bring in Galascheni, who would have been part of the three up front that Mastrelli was employing at the time, behind Cinaglia. He also brought in the goalkeeper, Felice Pelucci, which translates in English, if you're interested, Pelucci is clean us up. So as a goalkeeper, when you're called clean us up, Philip clean us up, it's a pretty decent name to have. And just for reference, if you're interested in this, as I am, I couldn't help but use that opportunity to go down a rabbit hole and look at some of the more modern footballers to see how they translate. Quite a few, so I try to limit it. But Kevin De Bruyne, do you know what his English literal translation would be?
I'd love to think playmaker, but go on.
Kevin the playmaker. That's great. No, it's Kevin the Brown is his name. So I think in England, we probably call him Kevin Brown. In his coach at the moment, Pep Guardiola, is Joseph Piggybank. So that makes so much sense now when you have that. I've got loads of others, but I won't bore you with it, although the De Boer twins actually means the farmer, so Frank and Ronald the farmer. But what I would say is if you're in Malaysia, you need to be careful if you're talking about Timo Pukki, the Finnish player that had a great career at Norwich, because Pukki in Malaysian, we all know a Pukki, but no one likes to be called a Pukki. But anyway, I digress from the main topic, which was the players that were brought in. So we've got Galashelli, who plays in a forward position, and he becomes very important in the 73-74 season in terms of contribution for goals. Pellucci in goal. I'd also got Sergio Petrelli, but a very box-to-box midfielder comes in, blonde hair, the blonde angel they called him, actually, Luciano Ri-Ciccone. Ri-Ciccone actually means King Ciccone on the continuation of literal translation. But Ri-Ciccone comes in. He was a beautifully looking footballer, you know, the Robbie Savage of his day in terms of his looks, the Brian Robson in terms of his style from box to box, and the Paul Gascoigne in terms of his practical jokes.
Yes, very accurate. We are going to hear more about his influence. So that team, as you say, it does achieve really something quite astoundingly impressive, actually, on promotion. They don't win the title, but they do take it to the last game. They miss out to, is it Juventus and Inter?
The 72-73 season, they've just gone up. They're completely unfancied, but they go right to game 30. It's a 16-team league in Serie A, as we've established previously when we talked about Napoli. And on the final day, they are absolutely in with a chance of winning it, but they lose to Napoli. Juve come from behind to win, and they end up winning the championship by two clear points. And Lazio finish a very, very credible third place in their first season back into Serie A.
It does set up what comes next, which kind of on multiple fronts is both, you know, a hugely successful season, but you sort of see the strains of keeping that side together, which would fiery be an accurate word to describe the attitude of that team?
Yeah, definitely. It was a kind of combination, I think, and it came out in the kind of close shave in 1972-73. The thing that really kept them in with a shout until the last game of the season, I think, was their defence, and particularly their defence at home. They only conceded 16 goals in 30 games. So that was pretty impressive. And I think at the back, the person who was instrumental in terms of kind of keeping it particularly tight at the back, and this is just an excuse to get another reference into the Northeast.
No, you're going
is
with
the
this.
Captain, Giuseppe Wilson, which, I mean, Giuseppe, good Italian name. Wilson, slightly less of an Italian name. Their centre-back was actually born in Darlington. He was born in 1945. His Italian mother had met his English father when he was serving in the British Army as well. And although the family moved to Italy when he was kind of 6 months old, he didn't spend a lot of time in Darlington. I'm not sure what kind of influence that had on him as an individual or as a player. Although I did read somewhere that he did later, after he retired, open an Italian restaurant in Darlington. I don't think it lasted long. The good people of Darlington maybe were looking for some other culinary taste. So
do you think Darlington
he joined
wasn't
Lazio
ready?
In 19. Yeah, he was looking for, where's the Nando? So he joined Lazio in 1969 and remained in Rome with Lazio for over a decade, playing over 300 games. He was also the captain of Lazio when they won the slightly less heralded Cup of the Alps as well in 1971. I know you like your obscure tournaments, and this didn't have Thomas Lipton involved on this particular occasion, but this was a competition between Italian, Swiss and French and German and teams, which was, after the Coppa Italia, the biggest thing I think Lazio had won until 73-74.
Oh, that's too good. Cup of the Alps. Does make sense. I mean, to be fair, that makes more sense than the Anglo-Italian Cup.
Doves, you're right. Wilson was probably one of the more kind of balanced of the team, and Jamie's touched on some of the other characters within the team, of which the kind of slightly explosive character of Canaglia was probably kind of part of that, but not all of that. There was a bit of a reputation within the team, first of all, for guns. The story goes that so many of the team carried guns that on one occasion, a pilot refused to take off with the players on board until they actually left their weapons behind to be collected. Before home games, the team would stay in a local hotel just on the outskirts of Rome, the Americana, just in the countryside, the beautiful countryside outside Rome. And Jamie's mentioned one of the players, Sergio Petrelli. He was the right back, sometimes playing into midfield, who couldn't be bothered to switch off one of his lights. So he just shot it instead, shot the ball out. And to stave off boredom, you can imagine, you know, some excitable footballers in their youth, in their finest years, they would tend to just shoot at anything. They'd have a gun and just shoot at things, lampposts, birds, rubbish bins, and even, unfortunately, some Roma fans who had come into the grounds of the hotel the night before a derby game to try and keep them awake and were chased off with firearms as well. So there was guns, and there was also probably a slightly toxic combination here. When they were on the pitch and when they were playing, Mistrelli got them playing. He got them playing very well and as a unit. Outside of that, it wasn't quite as cohesive. So the players tended to change in two separate dressing rooms. And if anybody stepped into the wrong changing room, that would usually end up in some kind of fight. Practice matches tended to turn into battles. Sometimes that turned into a fight as well. Hugely competitive games would take place during the week. They would just keep on playing until somebody won. Quite a few of the first team players only wore shin pads in the training games, not in Serie A as well. They would, you know, no shin pads for the real game. Training games, all the protection they could get. Although there is an incident actually in 1974, just after winning the Scudetto, when Canaglia actually ran over and kicked his teammate Di Amico up the backside at the San Siro because his marking wasn't quite up to the standards that were expected.
It was quite common as well that the players themselves would fight verbally, not physically, during matches. And this is the genius of the coach. Mistrelli, when he spotted this, he wouldn't let him back in the changing room. He'd leave him on the pitch to resolve their differences whilst the rest of the team were being coached into how they were going to adapt to the second half. And I think that's why Tommaso Mistrelli absolutely needs a huge amount of credit in how he steered this Lazio team to promotion and then winning as they do their first Scudetto, because he was able to harvest just under incredible circumstances where you've got a split group. He was still able to harvest a unity in the team that was able to get the best out of all the players. And yeah, the split was pretty much right down the middle.
I found an Italian book, and with the joys of Google Translate, managed to pick out some of the passages. The book is called Guns and Balls, the first Lazio Scudetto. And the team was described as, quote, crazy, wild and sentimental, gunslingers and paratroopers, gamblers and nightclub dancers, a team divided into clans. And somehow Mistrelli got them playing.
It's weird, that sort of team spirit or non-team spirit or, you know, whatever you call it, it was at the heart of it. I mean, so he's, because he basically takes a team from the second tier, almost wins Serie A the first time of asking for a team that's never done that before, never come close to it really before. And then it's not like he goes and signs, you know, another 5-6 players to strengthen the side for the, it's pretty much the same side, isn't it, Jamie?
Yeah, it is. So he did his investment in the previous season before they went into their first season back into Serie A when they finished third, just narrowly missing out on the last game of the season. In the 73-74 season, there are no significant signings. And in Italy, they did have transfer windows. They have the summer window and the autumn window, as they called it. He doesn't recruit. He doesn't really sell. He doesn't recruit. I think what he knows is probably similar to a couple of podcasts ago when we talked about Louis Van Gaal, Louis Van Gaal's army. And he saw the quality within his ranks. He understood the quality of his players. And it was a case of applying his coaching tactics and his methods in order to maximize the potential. And that's exactly what he does. So they've had a year in Serie A where they've narrowly missed out on the championship. So they must have a hunger. They must have an appetite. They've come so close. You're going to come back in the next year. And with this coach galvanizing them to focus on, do you know what? We can actually do this. We can win this thing. And giving them that mentality, then I think you're stacking your odds in your favor. And I think this is why probably talk too much about Tommaso Maestrelli as a bit of a genius, and didn't have a massive career. I mean, Lazio, the team we're talking about now, that really is his career. Foggia did well, Reggina he did fairly well, but the genius of a coach at just that particular moment that knows how to get the best out of his players.
And he gets the best out of Canaglia in particular in that season. He is top scorer that year, 24 goals, helps them get all the way through to winning the league. Just as but it's fascinating. I mean come on to it if you've got a bit more detail on it, Jamie, on that first win. They end up with a very creditable record. They lose 5, win 18 of their 30 league games, and score 45 goals actually, which is compared to some Italian teams that won the league at that time, is, you know, dare I say it, free scoring. But just as we'll talk a bit about, because this becomes part of the story for Lazio later on in their career and Italian football throughout. Looking through that league table, I'm absolutely struck by if you look at the bottom four clubs who finished that year, which is Sampdoria, Foggia, Genoa, and Hellas Verona, there's little asterisks next to three of those four clubs. And what you'd see now is, you'd see it in English. You only have to look in League One now. You see points deducted due to going into administration or falling foul of fair play leagues, fair play rules, or football finance fair play rules. So Sampdoria are deducted 3 points for alleged bribery. Genoa are deducted 6 points for bribery. And Hellas Verona are demoted in the last place for bribery. So... three already. There's only 16 teams in that league. Three of them have a big chunk of points deducted for bribery, and that is something that goes on to become a theme, not just that season, but across several years in Italian football.
It's not a good look, is it? And it's obviously important not to stereotype the Italian league, yeah, and Italians. Generally, we might touch on the politics later, but it's definitely not good to stereotype. But there was later on in the decade a scandal which actually pulled in the skipper, the captain Wilson, in his final years when he was spending some of his time on loan with the New York Cosmos as well. This was a betting scandal called the Totonero betting scandal, which took place in 1980, where Lazio were one of 5 teams in Serie A at the time, and 2 teams actually in Serie B, in the second division, who were found guilty of illegal betting. Probably the person who was most famously implicated in the betting scandal was Paolo Rossi. He was suspended initially for 3 years, but reduced to 2 years on appeal, which meant that he was able to return and help Italy to win the 1982 World Cup. The background is, in Italy, there was a state-run pool for citizens to bet on football. It was really the only form of legalised football betting in the country, probably until the late 1990s. We see it everywhere now, don't we, on the grounds and in the TV and on team shirts. But in the time, it was tightly regulated, particularly in Italy, where Italians will be able to kind of correctly try and pick out the outcome of 12 games, making it at the time very difficult to kind of fix because there were so many teams involved in this. If we kind of fast forward onto 1980, there were a couple of individuals involved in the scandal and later became the whistleblowers as well. Alvaro Trinca was a restaurant owner, and Massimo Cruciano was a fruit and vegetable trader who knew each other. Trinca had a restaurant in Rome called La Lampara, where lots of Lazio players, including Pino Wilson, used to kind of hang out after games. And it was actually here that this plan was hatched. Certain players would receive money to fix games, which Cruciani and his friends would then bet on illegally. And working together, you would try and fix the result in at least 8 of the games across 12 weeks between 1979 and 1980. Unfortunately, they weren't very good at fixing things. They got off to a bad start. In the first game they tried to fix, the Lazio players missed their flight. I'm not sure if it was because of guns or not, before a friendly game against Palermo, and the game was void, so they couldn't bet on it. The next was only a little bit better, game between Palermo and Tartanto, which was fixed as a draw, but ended up with an away win. So they didn't get that well. It probably wasn't only until the third attempt game involving Perugia that the fix actually worked. And at that point, they were only around £3,000 up, but they kind of got some confidence and started placing bigger bets on some of the games. Given the amount of players involved and given the amount of clubs involved, it wasn't really surprising that the rumour started to kind of get out. Some bookmakers, and illegal bookmakers usually, because they were betting outside of the standard regulated system, refused to take their bets. And then a Lazio player kind of came out and hinted in an interview with a journalist that there was this system of illegal betting that was kind of taking place. The real problem came that Trinca and Cruciani, because of their very poor betting, had managed to lose over about 100 million lira by February 1980, which is about £450,000 today. They'd managed to stack up a fair amount of credit and bad credit with Italian illegal bookmakers who were not particularly happy and didn't particularly want to wait for their lira back. The family started to receive threats, unfortunately. The real problem, Cruciani's vegetable lorries were burnt. It was, you know, it was a threat to his livelihood. And it was at that point that Cruciani went to the authorities. He taped some of his conversations with the players, including Gino Wilson, and had copies of some of the checks. And it all ended up with the public prosecutor, 27 players, 13 clubs across the two divisions were involved, and our good friends Trinca and Cruciani ended up in prison.
Far from the only scandal to hit this or any other decade, Lazio winning the Scudetto for the first time. It's a really big deal, isn't it, Jamie?
Yeah, it is. As Phil's mentioned, they really do lock up at the back. Their defence is absolutely watertight in terms of its concession of goals. And in the season that they win the Scudetto, their first Scudetto in 73-74, they have, in the shape of Cinaglia, who we spoke about, scoring 24 goals, which is over 50% contribution to the total goals in that particular season for Lazio. And also Galascelli scores 10. So between them, they've chopped up 34 goals, 34 league goals, out of, I think, 45, which is a contribution of over 75%. So when you've got a tight defence and you've got quality defensive midfielders, which this particular team had, obviously Wilson playing as the sweeper at the back, you've got Oddi, which also translates as "oh man," if you're interested in English, Oddi, at the back. And then you've got this tight midfield that's working hard. Nani Frustalupi, which was part of the split. Frustalupi and Cinaglia didn't get on. They were the two that were split. And you've got the brilliance of the blonde angel, King Ciccone, Rui Ciccone, working hard. Your defence is going to be solid. And then you've got up front these guys that are banging in the goals. You're always going to have a chance. And that's exactly what happens in this particular season in 73-74.
It's a highly impressive win. Lazio, by virtue of winning the Scudetto, they obviously go into the European Cup, as it was then, for the next season, or they should have. But Phil, whilst they were highly successful in the Italian League that year, Europe had brought some more adventures, hadn't it?
Yeah, they'd qualified for the UEFA Cup, and Lazio were drawn against Ipswich in the second round. It's probably worth noting that Ipswich were coming off the fantastic victory against Real Madrid in the first round of the UEFA Cup. So this was the beginning of that really good Ipswich team with Bobby Robson. Italians went to Portman Road in the first leg. Mistrelli made a few changes to tighten his defence, but that backfired. Ipswich raced to a 4-0 lead. Trevor Wymark managed to score four goals. There was a slight amount of controversy about the fourth goal. The Italians were upset that and because they felt that Wymark had handled the ball. In fact, there's a story that follows that a delegation of AC Roma supporters, obviously Lazio's biggest rivals, arrived to make a presentation with the press photographers, where the Roma president handed Wymark a trophy with an inscription that said, "To Wymark in recognition of Ipswich versus Lazio 4-0, with gratitude and affection." So one side of Rome was happy about that result. Another side of Rome wasn't happy with that result. So you get to the second leg in the Olympic stadium. Much tighter game this time. Lazio opened the scoring in just 43 seconds, added another after 9 minutes. A third goal after 26 minutes, so the Italians were well back into the game. They were then pegged back on 73 minutes when the Dutch referee awarded Ipswich what was felt to be a kind of soft penalty after Clive Woods had been tripped in the box. Wymark went to congratulate the penalty taker, Colin Villignon, but was chased back into his own goal mouth by the Lazio player, so he didn't quite manage to make it. Canaglia scored a penalty in the 82nd minute, so it's a pretty tight finish. But obviously, with the away goals rule, they fell short. And in injury time, David Johnson scored for Ipswich, and there was a 6-4 victory for Ipswich. The Italians were not going to leave this there. The final whistle, the Ipswich players sprinted to the dressing room, which is probably a kind of wise thing. The Ipswich goalkeeper, David Best, had to furthest to run, and he managed to get kicked on a number of occasions on his way to the dressing room. The Lazio fans got onto the pitch, despite the huge metal fence and the moat between them. They were throwing beer cans and rockets at the police. Tear gas was involved. The police were trying to maintain control, but not particularly successfully. The Ipswich players ended up being locked in their own dressing room with lots of angry fans, including potentially some of the Lazio players banging on the door, trying to get in. The referee was locked in his changing room for quite a while. He managed to get out through a hidden exit. And after a couple of hours, the Ipswich players managed to escape as well when things had quietened down, but only because they were able to use the Lazio team coach to get themselves back to the hotel. That was bad enough, but the real problem for Lazio was that following the warning from UEFA after the incident with Arsenal earlier on in the decade, this was kind of a second strike. And despite winning the Scudetto for the first time in 74 years, they were banned from UEFA for playing in the European Cup the next season.
Phil, one of the things I read about those events that I couldn't help but chuckle, and I don't know if you've been able to confirm this or you're able to confirm this, was that during towards the end when it was just about to kick off, the Lazio fans are raining all types of missiles onto the pitch, of which then the Lazio players were picking them up and then throwing them at the Ipswich Town players as well whilst the game was drawing to its conclusion. I couldn't help but hope that to be true because of the hilarity of it.
Yeah. I've managed to find some very grainy black and white pictures, even though it's 1974 on YouTube. I couldn't see anybody particularly doing that. It was probably just because the pictures were so bad, but I definitely saw reporting that was taking place. And there was a rumour that one of the people banging on the Ipswich dressing room door was Canaglia, who was particularly determined to try and talk to the Ipswich players.
Yet another of the teams, these classic teams, these great teams, who were denied for various reasons their, maybe one and only opportunity to appear in a prestigious European league, as of course I'm talking about Oxford United in the Milk Cup, winners of 86, obviously, but other teams, other maybe more heralded teams exist as well. I do recognise that, but yeah, it's a really sad element to this. And actually, this whole story has tragic and grim circumstances to it all. But this is, you know, one of those examples of, you know, even at the heights of what they're achieving, that it is troubled, and so they miss out on playing in the European Cup. And at the time, obviously, it was genuinely for league winners. So it was to be some years before they would get there again, or get the chance to get there again. While that's the only title this team wins, it's not like it falls off a cliff, is it? They actually have quite a good year the following season as well, Jamie, don't they?
Yeah, they make a fair defence of their title-winning season in Serie A. The team is largely kept together in terms of the playing staff. There's no major losses, but they're unable to defend their trophy. They finish in a credible fourth behind champions Juventus on 43 points. They got 37 points. When they go into the UEFA Cup, and because their European ban has been reduced to a year and not the 3 years it originally was, they can compete in that one. So they're back in Europe to cause all manner of mayhem. But yeah, it's a fair season, and there's still, I guess, optimism for this football team. But things do change.
That 75-76 season is where all manner of things start to go wrong for the club. And probably the first thing that probably begins that whole thing is Mastrelli stepping down as manager.
Yeah, so Tommaso Mastrelli unfortunately has to step down because he's diagnosed with terminal cancer in 1976. His caretaker comes in, Giuliano Corsi, takes control of the team, but he doesn't have the authority that Tommaso had. He probably doesn't have the relationship that Mastrelli had with the players. So the foundations are crumbling at this particular point. And Cinaglia himself has grown restless and has become, is slowly transitioning from hero to villain of the piece.
He's already thinking about another life in the US, isn't he, by this point, where he does ultimately end up?
Yeah, he's married to an American lady. She moves back to the United States. And as we discovered with the brilliant Michael Lewis last week, the NASL is the league that really is the place to be at that particular moment at time. You've got Pelé and Beckenbauer over there. So Cinaglia, who's got an American wife living in America, wants a piece of the NASL action.
Which is what comes at the end of that season. He scores, I think he scores 9 goals that in the 75-76 season, having scored 14 the previous and 24 the year before, having this extraordinary run of goal scoring. And I mean, Lazio arguably should have gone down. So it goes right down to goal difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, the thing is, 13th in a 16-team league, and they survive relegation on goal difference. That's what keeps them up. And they lose Frustalupa. He gets sold to Cassina. I can't imagine what it's like. So you got Frustalupi, who is the yin to Cinaglia's yang. This is where the fractious groups have come from. The manager has sadly lost his fight with cancer. And you've got your two mainstays, your two on-the-field leaders who lead these two split groups are both gone. Cinaglia departs for the NASL, and Frustalupi is sold to Cassina. So everything that was solid about that football club appears to have been broken apart. And with a new coach coming in, it feels that trying to rebuild what was is an impossible job.
Yeah, I think for Cinaglia, there was a number of different issues. He'd had quite a bad, well, Italy had had quite a bad World Cup in 1974, and he'd been criticised personally because of Italy's poor performance. And there was the tension between Lazio and Roma and the supporters, and I think Cinaglia was getting a lot of abuse from the opposition supporters. He probably didn't help himself because of his attitude on the pitch and also off the pitch. He became quite associated with right-wing politics. And I suppose in the 1970s, most of the football teams had been kind of associated with the left. but it was Lazio that was kind of had lots of kind of connections with right-wing politics. And in 1972, a number of Lazio players, including Cinaglia's, declared publicly that they would vote for the Italian social movement, the MSI, who had attempted to distance itself from its kind of fascist roots, but it was a far-right political party. It was led by Giorgio Almirante, who had been responsible for anti-Semitic roundups during the Nazi puppet state, the Republic of Salo, between 1943 and 1945. So I think I'm on safe ground in pointing out the connections between far-right politics and the MSI. Whether Cinaglia and the other players were particularly politically motivated or just trying to wind people up, I don't know. But he got a lot of criticism. So by the point that you've kind of got, by the time that the manager has died, he's already in America. The tensions that were kind of forming within Rome and the criticism he's got were kind of pushing him further and further away from Italy at that point.
Phil, that's a great point about the, because with Lazio, there were, it's reported, not that I want to get down the politics, Italian politics in particular, a rabbit hole, because it is a serious subject. But Lazio did have, the players certainly appear to have right-wing sympathies in terms of how they felt about the state of the country at the time. And Mussolini, who obviously led his fascist movement supporting the Nazis in the Second World War, history suggests that he was a Lazio fan. That was his team of choice. Although you could probably learn with Mussolini that he would just follow whoever's winning if you read some accounts in terms of Italian nationalism. But yeah, so the right wing has always been associated with Lazio. So it would be no surprise or no shock that if you've got players on the staff, they're going to have some right wing sympathies.
Lazio, from the very early stages, from the early 1900s, had connections with right-wing politics. The club had been formed by Italian army officers and it adopted a slightly martial ethos. Obviously, the team's logo is a rather strident-looking eagle, a symbol that was later used by the Italian fascists. And as you said, Jamie, there was some suggestion that it was Benito Mussolini's team and he was known to appear in the stands. Particularly from the 1930s, one of his favourite players, one of the best Italian players at the time, Silvio Piolo, he was a bit of a fan there. Obviously, it's kind of dangerous. You can pull too many kind of connotations. It's not helped, of course, when the supporters to this day, and the ultras in particular, are known to make stiff-armed salutes. And it's particularly not helpful when one of the players, not naming anybody in particular, but Paolo Di Canio does something similar on the pitch. There is a link between Lazio and Mussolini in 2021, Romano Floriani Mussolini, who was the great-grandson of Benito Mussolini, was an unused substitute for Lazio. So that's the most recent connection. But of course, you can't blame the great-grandson of a fascist dictator for what his family did in years past.
That's an incredible fact. So yes, this it's definitely, and it, you know, this it is a period of its time, and we talk about national service, and you know, guns have been part of this story all along, and you've also, you know, pranks and, you know, how players fill their time in between games, a lot of downtime, you know, have long been associated with it. It obviously goes, you know, there's just an incredible, you know, hugely tragic story. And actually, you know, in terms of this team.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably important to point out that the reason why the players were armed with guns was the reason why many men and women across the whole of the nation of Italy were carrying guns is because in the late 1960s, there were a series of terrorist attacks. There was a series of bombings. There was unrest and it was legal to carry arms. And that's why Italians would have been carrying guns. You know, and it's also the era of the Godfather and the Godfather Part Two as well, where guns are definitely a prominent character. But we've got our blonde hair angel, Re Ciccone. He's a practical joker and he's fairly well liked. And even though he kind of sits in one of the splits. He does kind of, he's a bridge between the two because he's a well-liked individual, but he likes a practical joke. And in the January of 1977, he and a couple of friends decided it would have been a very funny practical joke to put on some masks, to go into a jewelry shop in the region of Rome and to point guns at the jeweler, Bruno Tappuccini, who was the owner, and say, this is a robbery. Hands up, this is a robbery. So him and his friend, Giorgio Fratticoni, and a teammate, Pietro Gedlin, they go into this jewelry store, they burst in, they point guns at the owner, who has been robbed himself not so long ago. A few weeks ago, he'd been part of a robbery. So he'd armed himself and he had his arms quite close by. So he was able to reach under his counter, pick out his gun and point the guns back to the robbers. Pietro Gedlin was able to kind of sense the severity of the situation and immediately put his hands up. Unfortunately for Luciano Riccioni, he didn't get it. And nor did the actual owner, Bruno Tappuccini, recognize the player. He didn't like football, so he didn't know the player at the time, even though there would have been masks involved, and consequently shot Riccioni point blank in the chest. And 30 minutes later, the 28-year-old died on the floor for a practical joke gone wrong.
It is difficult. I mean, how is the whole thing is ludicrous, but you factor in what it means for beyond football, football terms, but what it means for a club, how you kind of deal with that kind of tragedy is extraordinary. And I think that's probably then where you kind of see that this team has completely disbanded and that kind of era is over. I mean, the star players have gone. The manager has died of cancer, and then you get this tragedy on top of that. So this is the end of that era. What sort of follows to them afterwards?
Well, as Phil's already alluded to, the Pino Wilson is caught in a scandal. The club suffer relegations into Serie B. They come up a bit through the 80s, but it's very much a yo-yo existence for Lazio until the early 1990s, where Cranoli takes over the football team and changes the fortune. But it's a very barren and desperate period for SS Lazio from the January 1977 onwards. So Riccioni himself, you know, 50 days before, he would have been carrying the coffin of his incredible coach Tommaso Mascarelli, and therein himself through what type of wisdom has gone and done a practical joke with guns, and it's turned out badly, and he himself is in a coffin. But it's just tragic that such a gifted young footballer with everything ahead of him, and at 28, you're kind of at your peak as a footballer, really, aren't you? Everything was stripped away from him through a moment of stupidity when you're trying to bring joy into someone's life, albeit with guns. It's just, it really is a tragic tale, and it really does mark the end of this incredible football team.
There is a sort of second coming, which comes, of course, in the 1990s when Craig Naughty arrives, and he brings in several players, including the incredible, obviously, Paul Gascoigne. Obviously, grateful that the gun culture had wasn't part of that, because he certainly had the pranking ability. And you add in, I mean, that was a hugely impressive side, and under Sven Göran Eriksson, they do go on and win a title, and they do go on to enter the European Cup, having been cruelly denied it previously.
You probably think of Lazio between 1997 and 2001 as the club's golden age. So under Sven Göran Eriksson, they won the Serie A title once again, and the Coppa Italia twice, and also reached the 1998 UEFA Cup final and the 1999 European Cup Winners' Cup final, and actually won that trophy in 1999. So that's probably a more sustained period of success for Lazio.
And it's probably worth pointing out that Eriksson team we're talking about that goes on, as Phil's rightly said, goes into their golden period. They win the the UEFA Super Cup, which, yeah, some people take it serious, some people don't take it serious, not so much in England, but they win the Super Cup by beating a team we've talked about on this podcast previously, Sir Alex Ferguson, as he was then, Manchester United's treble-winning team. So this Lazio team win the Super Cup by beating Fergie's treble champions. And I think Fergie must have had an eye on the team because he goes on to sign what I would say is one of my favourite ever players that I've ever seen play football live. Wasn't really successful at Manchester United or Chelsea, but Juan Sebastian Verón was an absolute luxury of a footballer.
It's unlike you, Jamie, to identify with the luxury of a footballer. Excellent. Okay, well, we should probably start thinking about ranking this Lazio side. I am absolutely torn on this one. So we do have five categories of greatness. All-time greats at the top, true greats, our middle category, touch greatness, edge of greatness, the one below that, and blinkered greats, plus our bonus category, which we rolled out as a novelty, not so much a rarity, last week for Rochester Lancers. That is not necessarily great, but without them, we wouldn't be where we are today. Jamie, let's begin with you. Where do you put this 1974 Lazio side in history?
It's almost Shakespearean, isn't it? You've got the fairy tale and the romance. You've got the genius in the coach, and you've got the tragedy of how the team is broken apart. The story is absolutely one of the all-time greats. The team itself, I would struggle to put them in our top bracket for various reasons. I would even struggle to put them in true greats. I'm kind of reaching down to the lower reaches. I think for a team to come up from any second tier and compete for a championship and narrowly miss out, and then to go on and win it is incredibly unique. The only one I can think of that we've covered on this podcast previously is Nottingham Forest. And we did rank Nottingham Forest as all-time greats, but they did go on and win two European Cups, which is one more than league titles, which is pretty impressive. I don't think Lazio are a Nottingham Forest. Lazio denied themselves the opportunity to go into European football at a time when Northern Europe was dominating the European Cup. Southern Europe through Spain and Italy and Portugal had had its day in the 60s. By the 1970s and by 1974-75, when this Lazio team were competing, they would have been going up against Don Rivies, Leeds United. They would have been going against Ajax. They would have been going against Bayern Munich. They would have been going against Liverpool. I don't think they would have won the European Cup, and I would love to be corrected on that. So I'm going to kick us off by possibly putting the cats amongst the Roman pigeons by putting them in the edge of greatness.
Edge of greatness. Would you go higher than that, Phil, or what do you think?
No, I agree. Edge of greatness. There was a hint that they could have threatened the dominance of the two Milan teams or Juventus, but it was really just a kind of, it was impossible to sustain the success of 1974, partly because of things that were outside of their control, particularly the illness of the manager, but other things that were within their control. You wonder whether actually the genesis of their decline was kind of built in to the DNA of the club, the divisions, the guns. Surely it wasn't sustainable for that club to be successful over a long period of time. I think the real crisis and the real problem was the death of Mastrelli, because he, as Jamie has mentioned, had a real human touch. He was known as a second father for many of the players. He managed to pull together a team with a few stars, but largely promising youngsters and journeymen. He'd bring together that team on the pitch. They would leave the fighting in the dressing room. They were tactically brilliant. And they put all that competitive tension to one side and directed against their opponents. But it was such a short period, I think. Touch of greatness. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the I think it's reasonable. I think you can make a case for Touch of Greatness. They definitely do touch greatness with that incredible single season, but they're sort of on the edge of greatness because they keep denying themselves the opportunity, either of their own making or the circumstances they're in, and that's sort of summed up by their being denied a place in the European Cup by virtue of that some ill discipline along the way. As you say, I think it's a story of an amazing moment, and it's a brilliant moment for Lazio in that history in a league in which they had done little from before that, and it was to be another 20 years or so before they would resurface again. Touch, bit edge, I don't know. Edge is a bit cruel, but I think it's going to win. But we put everyone in Touch of Greatness. I might bring them back in the promotion relegation episode. But I think for now, Lazio, 50 years on, 1974, Edge of Greatness. Excellent. Okay, so that's all we have time for this week. Phil, thanks for venturing out of the Northeast.
My pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
It is a great story, absolutely fascinating story. Jamie, thank you as ever.
Oh, absolute pleasure as always. And Phil, thank you for the Shaw Taylor reference. That's really made my night.
Shaw Taylor. We get just not someone we thought we were going to be talking about at the start of this podcast. That is all we have time for. As a reminder, you can visit our website, thegreatestteam.co, where you can find all our previous episodes, links to some of our team sheets that we have, where we put together the starting 11s, primary starting 11s for these sides. And, of course, you can see all our slightly bizarre rankings that we've decided to give people along the way. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast if you've enjoyed it, and we will speak again soon.